It's expected that Utah's inland port, a hub for industry and transportation that's planned for Salt Lake City's northwest quadrant, will be one of the biggest drivers of economic development in the state's history. You may have heard about the politics of the project, a sort of tug of war between the state of Utah and Salt Lake City. One criticism is that the entire process has been, and remains, largely opaque. Another critique is that the voices of West Side residents aren't being heard. This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means.
I just want to welcome everyone to District 1. There's a lot of great things that District 1 has to offer. I'm sure you're well aware of the Utah.
Nearly every seat was filled at the Inland Port Authority Board's recent meeting, held at the West Point Workforce Training and Education Center. One of the main themes of the night was the public's concern over the board's closed subcommittee meetings. But that wasn't all the community had to say. Some also worried about the air they breathe and preserving the nature around them.
My name is Robin Adamson. I am a volunteer for environmental issues. I live in the downtown area for 30 plus years. I am a single parent of three kids, and all three of my kids have asthma as well as I do. My concern is that according to the CDC, we have 14.5 per million deaths related to asthma every year. And we are second only to Oregon, who already has a seaport and has 16 people per million of deaths for asthma every year. We realize we're in a bowl. We realize that we have one of the most unique geographical areas in the world that we get to deal with, but we don't think that should be a reason to give up. We think that should be a reason to catapult us forward into new technologies, into a net zero port, electric vehicles to transport some of the things that will be coming and going, and that we implement things like living freeways and sequestration out of the air and issues like that. That's what we want. The health issues aren't constrained to asthma. I work with ESLC air protectors. I know that's a concern for our organization. There's a lot of us out there that are banding together to not necessarily shut down the port, but ask that it be net zero and ask that it not further endanger our citizens' health.
My name is Richard Holman. I'm co-chair of the Westside Coalition. The purpose of the coalition is to advocate for the health, safety, and quality of life of Westside residents. I moved here about 2.5 years ago from my home in Idaho after retiring. I live in Rose Park, so I'm directly adjacent to what's going to happen at the Inland Port. I have an interest in the success of everyone. The Inland Port, my neighbors, all of the companies that I hope will come and find a welcoming atmosphere here. We already are seeing reductions in the water that's being generated from the mountains based on snowfall. If you look at this year's numbers, they're not looking good. Reservoirs are down. And here we're adding another draw, and many industries use a good amount of water in their processing and their cooling. And I'm concerned about where that water is going to exactly come from and what conservation measures we are thinking about today in order to preclude the loss of that water, either through evaporation or contamination or other means, just in the manufacturing processes that I would expect to exist at the port. I think we all are concerned with the effluents that come from the port, whether they be water effluent, whether it's air pollution. There's been just a jam full of studies here in the last 2 days about the impact of air pollution on intelligence. I kind of take that serious, and any kind of effluent coming out of a port facility has to be treated in some way. It really doesn't matter what it is, whether it's dust, whether it's debris, whether it's water, whether it's air. We should be putting it back into the environment better than the way we found it.
My name is Dorothy Pappas Owen. I am the chair of the West Point Community Council, and I have lived in West Point, which is the most western community of Salt Lake City, for about 35 years. Well, one of the advantages of having lived here for this many years and also being the community council chair is that it's your responsibility to get to know your community and the people that live here. And so I've had an opportunity to walk and meet with all the people here. You know, if you live here, Annette, it's a real gem. It is a unique combination of living in a very vibrant city of Salt Lake and being in a very rural agricultural setting. When I went and visited people yesterday to talk to them about this meeting today and encourage them to be here, I mean, there's a whole herd of fawns that were hiding out in the grass watching me as we talked. If you walk and you talk with people, you begin to realize what a gem this area is. This is not just a West Side issue. You know, the environment, especially the air quality and the water, is going to be impacted by all of us. And the fact that that's listed way down the line of things that they're concerned about is very concerning to people. They need to develop a really strong assessment of the impacts of what's being proposed. I mean, first they need to determine a business plan, and that business plan needs to identify the impacts of what they're doing and how they're going to implement their plans and still maintain an air quality that we can all live with and literally live with.
Environmental impacts and the health repercussions of those impacts from the planned inland port were a major concern to many residents attending the meeting. Someone who spends a good deal of time thinking about those effects is Tim Collins, a geography professor at the University of Utah. His research focuses on human geography and, in particular, environmental justice. Many people have an idea of what social justice looks like. We might think about the civil rights movement or LGBTQ activism or feminism. But where does environmental justice fit in?
Really, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was the anti-toxics movement that started to sort of emerge in the late 70s, and the civil rights movement through the 60s and into the 70s gained a lot of ground. And in the early 80s, really there's one moment where people really, the concept of environmental racism really jumped onto people's radar screen. In North Carolina, there was a county that was like predominantly Black African-American county that was being targeted for a landfill of toxic waste, and they really had no involvement in the process to decide where it was going. And a lot of leadership from the civil rights movement actually came in to try to support the community. They ended up failing. The landfill was sited, but not before there were really public demonstrations that gained national media attention. And so after that moment, people started conducting studies to try to understand whether there was disproportionate exposure for sort of poor and minority communities to some of these toxic hazards that people were really concerned about, and the health effects were being documented. And sure enough, a lot of the research that was conducted and continues to be conducted has documented this sort of pattern of unequal exposure for poor minority communities. And the more work that's being done that's looking at other axes of social differences tends to actually find similar things, like we did a paper on LGBTQ sort of communities and disproportionate exposure to toxic pollution. And so, but anyway, the focus of the literature is primarily on race and class, race and socioeconomic status, and a lot of the studies tend to find this disparate pattern. And so concerns were raised, and a lot of activism from the environmental justice activist community was sort of directed toward government agencies to do something about it. And for example, at the federal level, the Environmental Protection Agency ended up getting involved, and enough pressure was placed on the federal government that I think in 1994, President Clinton signed an executive order. It's Executive Order 12898 that sort of directs all federal agencies to consider the sort of disproportionate impacts, health impacts of its programs, policies, and activities on minority and low-income populations. So there's this federal sort of environmental justice executive order that exists. And some states have adopted their own state-level environmental justice orders, too. I'm not sure. I don't think Utah is on board with that.
So you mentioned this toxic landfill in North Carolina, but what environmental issues do marginalized communities often deal with that other communities don't?
Poor air quality is a big one, and so oftentimes poor minority communities tend to be situated in where the densest traffic is and in old industrial zones. or even newer zones where there's current industry operating. So you get a lot of pollution exposures that have been documented. And so that's a big one that's probably most of the research is focused on. But, you know, I've done research more recently, like on flood hazards, for example, in Houston. And we have a study we're doing like on Hurricane Harvey that focuses on disproportionate flood impacts for poor and minority communities there. So a lot of work's focused on sort of those environmental hazards. But people have also done environmental justice research focused on access to sort of like healthful foods, you know, food deserts, access to green space and parks, and found a similar pattern whereby these poor minority communities have worse access to those sorts of environmental amenities too.
Sure. I know like the key to this is why, right? Why do these industrial projects, you know, highways, oil refineries or whatever it is, why do they get placed in these communities? And I guess I'm wondering, in the planning meetings, is anyone saying that, you know, this is a community where they won't mind having these sorts of projects? Or what does it look like to you?
That's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of it's very hard to find clear evidence for targeting communities based on those characteristics, although there have been these sort of some things have been leaked over the years, like consultants' reports that have sort of directed polluting industries to sort of target areas where you have poorer communities, where people are less likely to effectuate resistance against the siting of sort of an undesirable land use in their midst. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea that some communities have less social capital and are less able to contest something like this is probably on the radar screen, although you're not likely to get people to talk about it explicitly. I think it is a reality. And then there's also sort of the market dynamics explanation that's like, well, the land tends to be cheaper. I suspect the inland port site is in an area that has good transportation proximate to it. So that's a key consideration. It just so happens that these may have low land values and also higher minority and low socioeconomic status, population characteristics as well, you know. And so there has been quite a bit of research where people have tried to separate the effects of like socioeconomic status and race. And a lot of the studies find that actually racial ethnic minority status, when you account for socioeconomic status, still has this significant effect. So race still matters above and beyond, you know, this economic market dynamics explanation people have found actually in most studies. So
it's not necessarily a conspiracy against all of these communities, but
right, a lot of these things combine, you know, the way these things play out, a lot of different factors come into play. And in the United States, there's this historical connection between race and class, right, that's longstanding. And, you know, when these interstate transportation system was first established, for example, a lot of people have studied how poor minority communities were targeted for the locations of the urban interstate highway system in the first place. And so it's hard to, when you start looking at the history of this, you start to understand a little bit more why all of these things are bound up together. And even with really good intention, it's hard to undo some of these patterns. And I think there's a similar pattern that exists here with where people live and where the transportation infrastructure is, and now where this new transportation and industrial development project is going to impact.
Well, let's talk about that. I know you're new to Utah, which is great because that gives you a bit of an outsider neutral perspective. But having looked at some of these plans for the inland port, what kind of environmental impact do you predict it will have on the nearby communities?
Well, so there's the transportation side of it. There's going to be, I suspect, more transportation, freight, trucking, diesel, exhaust, there's going to be more air pollution associated with this enhanced traffic flow. But I also understand there's an industrial, perhaps a manufacturing and industrial component to what's going on too, which also has its own environmental effects typically. So there's going to be another pollution stream that would come from industrial activity that's connected with the inland port. And so it doesn't take it's not much of a stretch to presume that there will be a larger pollution footprint once this is placed mm-hmm. where the plans are to place it. That area right. will be more impacted environmentally.
The Inland Port has been called, you know, one of the biggest economic development projects in state history. But for future economic development projects, what would you recommend to take environmental justice into consideration?
Well, so if I look at, there's a definition of environmental justice that really does focus, the EPA has adopted it, that really focuses on the process itself. And so, I mean, I tend to focus on these disparate outcomes, but people in the environmental justice activists are concerned whether their voices are being heard and whether they have a seat at the table in the decision-making process. So the EPA defines environmental justice as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, enforcement, environmental laws, regulations, and policies. And so when you have a large project like this from the outset, there should be a public forum, you know, at various stages in the process that bring people to the table and allow them to express their concerns and maybe discuss ways that the impact could be mitigated to the greatest degree possible, and environmental pollution coming from the project, and also ways that maybe such a project, given all the revenue that I expect is going to be generated from it, could maybe go back into the community development initiatives for those communities nearby who are probably going to have the most negative impacts. What might be done to compensate in some way for those communities, parks, health facilities, things that people are concerned about in their daily lives that contribute to their well-being. It would be nice if some of the revenue being generated from these types of projects could go back into that community development effort for these communities.
Well, Tim Collins from the University of Utah Geography Department, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Collins mentioned how projects that impact the environmental health of an area disproportionately affect communities of color and lower-income communities. In Salt Lake County from 2000 to 2010, data from the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute show that neighborhoods west of I-15 have the highest concentrated population of people of color in the county. And that's State Representative Angela Romero's home base. A Democrat from the Glendale neighborhood of Salt Lake City, Romero represents House District 26, where, compared with the rest of the state, there are proportionately more people of color. It's an area that's bound by freeways, I-215, I-15, I-80, and also railways. Romero is known in the legislature for her work regarding victims' rights, but she's also an advocate for environmental justice in her community. So how did she get involved?
By mistake. And it's interesting because I've always been an advocate for social justice issues, and in particularly women and communities of color and LGBTQIA. And so I've always been passionate about social justice issues involving people, but I really never thought about how the environment plays a role. When I was first elected in 2012, one of the first committees I was assigned to was public utilities, energy, and technology. I didn't know anything about the grid. I didn't know anything about rooftop solar.
You're not a scientist. You're not
a scientist.
An energy industry
representative. No, not an energy industry insider, as many of the people I serve on in public utilities have a background in energy. Most of it's from coal. So I was kind of brand new, learning stuff. And I happened to get invited to go to the National Caucus for Environmental State Legislators, their annual committee meeting. And so when I was there, I learned about the bleaching of the coral reef, and it totally changed my whole perspective on environmental justice and how does that tie into public health and how does that impact communities of color and low-income communities that are on the margins. So I didn't think about it anymore from, oh, it's just those people who want to change, you know, they're concerned about the environment mm-hmm. that fit this certain stereotype. It was like, this is about all of us, and this is about Mother Earth, and this is about my culture and my community, and how do I ensure that kids growing up in the district I represent don't play outside when it's a red air day? How do I make sure that I'm protecting their health and their family's health?
Yeah.
And my way of doing that is looking at alternative energy, in particular looking at clean energy and renewable and how we move forward as a state.
So talking about air quality, I want to get into that a little bit more, but you know, like you said, you represent areas of the west side of Salt Lake City. Besides air quality, what kind of environmental concerns do you have for your district?
Besides air quality, I'm looking at sound, lighting, and water as we look at just the environmental impact that what we produce by energy. Like, I'm looking at freight switchers. I never really thought about that. What are these trains mm-hmm. carrying on our tracks? What can we do to upgrade our freight switchers? Because that pollutes a lot of the area within my district. And so looking at things I normally didn't look at, like water, where does the water come from? When someone takes a shower and they're taking medication, how does that water go back into mm-hmm. our sewage system? How does lighting impact the way people sleep or how if they get enough sleep when if they're working 12-hour days, sure. they take the bus home, they're walking home, and there's improper lighting? Like, how mm-hmm. does that impact them and their health? And sound walls, like, we don't really think about sound walls, but part of my district runs by a freeway. So the higher the sound wall, the less noise, and people can sleep properly. But also, when we're having these inversions, it's harder for the inversion to come into the neighborhood.
That's interesting. Let's talk about the inversions. Research from the University of Utah Department of Atmospheric Sciences from this past year shows that during the winter inversions, areas on the west side, like Rose Park and even West Valley City, fare really poorly. And that's, like you said, due to the proximity to large roads, Redwood Road, I-15, the airport, exactly, and the oil refineries. So talking with your constituents and as a resident yourself, how does the air quality impact their quality of life?
Well, it impacts all our quality of life. And right now, Senator Escamilla, who is the senator over a majority of my district, and I have been working with a team of atmospheric scientists and looking at that inequality that exists. And we were able to get $100,000 in ongoing funding to fund their Trax Line project, which measures the air. And so that's something we'll continue to work on. There's some other projects we're working with them right now in regards to school recess guidelines and how to, you know, we always rely on Hawthorne, but maybe that's not the only air monitor we should be relying on.
And that's the elementary school.
Elementary school, yes.
7th East and 17th
exactly.
South.
And we also have an air monitor at Rose Park. But for us, it's like the air might be suitable at 8 o'clock, but that doesn't mean it's going to be, it might turn from yellow mm-hmm. to red by 1.
Yeah.
Depending on how
the
wind
blows. By the next recess time is
exactly. So we're working on that right now. That won't be ready until probably in December. But I'm excited to kind of see what comes out of that in the sense of what we can do to be more preventative. So when I look at air quality, I look at it from a public health perspective. A lot of people like to get caught up in whether it's about climate change or whether it's about this or whether it's about that. Climate change is real. Sorry to tell people out there that don't believe in it. But for me, my whole goal is, like, how do we protect people? How do we make sure that if people are living in the city, how do they protect themselves and their children? One way is through RESIS guidelines. Another way is to ensure that if it's a really bad air day and there are other ways to get to work, those alternative, whether it's carpooling or whether it's using public transportation. And if you have to go outside, I know it's not the fad, but wearing an inversion mask, so important to protect your health. And so those are all the things, like, I'm working with local community members, as well as trying to educate the community about how the air impacts their public health.
Representative Angela Romero, thank you so much for talking with me and taking the time.
And thank you for having me.
Romero mentioned working with Senator Luz Escamilla, a Democrat from Utah's 1st Senate District, on air quality monitors. Escamilla's district is ground zero for the Inland Port and other developments, including the state prison relocation. A few legislative sessions ago, Escamilla crafted a bill in response to environmental concerns about the prison, specifically over particulate matter from transportation of construction materials. With the announcement of the Inland Port, similar concerns have arisen. And so, Escamilla says, has the need for new legislation to research the environmental health of her district before construction begins.
The state prison is nothing comparing, you know, when you're talking about size and the Inland Port. So now this has obviously raised the concern in terms of not only air quality, but water quality, lighting, pollution, and sound. So if you think about being a resident in the Northwest Quadrant, specifically on West Point and Rose Park, I mean, what does this mean that we're not going to have, you know, and then Port, and what do we do to, A, understand what we currently have in place, so our baseline of data, right? I mean, we're not collecting enough data to know what we currently have in place. I mean, there are some air quality monitors that DEQ has, but there's more things that we need to do, and that's kind of like where my legislation is moving. It's trying to, before the construction starts, we need to start collecting data now.
Escamilla hopes that the data collected would illuminate some issues that leaders should take into consideration in the planning of projects, though she suspects we're a little too far with the development of the state prison to take any preventative measures. But for the Inland Port, Escamilla says the goal is to be proactive rather than reactionary.
I know there's ways that we can do this, and maybe they're going to be very costly, but I think there is a responsibility of the state to be proactively looking into that. So I'm hoping that at least with a baseline of information and data, we can say, look, I mean, this is where we are, and it's already bad enough, because we do have bad air quality, for example, in this area. And if we put these mechanisms in place, we can prevent to get it worse. I mean, it's going to increase, but this will, you know, if we can put incentives, for example, for companies that want to bid for the construction of the inland port for them, the more green they are, the more friendly they are, you know, if they're looking into reducing emissions, they will get extra points on their procurement process. Does that make sense? It's getting to that place where it won't be me necessarily making those decisions, but in this case, for example, the Inland Port Authority. And that's my goal, is that this is information for them so they can, as they move forward, and make recommendations, because this is going to be moving and it's changing. But also for the constituents and the state constituents to know, because of transparency, that this information is available and they need to know what's happening in their community.
How do you feel about the effects of development on your community's environment? Weigh in at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3. Special thanks to In the Hive intern Sarah Sadie Khan and the rest of the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.